I'm T2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. It's time we begin the TechNet, as we do every Sunday evening for the last 34 or so years. As you guys have heard so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious amateurs come together and teach each other more about what's going on with wireless and radio equipment, transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, antennas, propagation, to 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM ham radio that you're listening to right now is just one of the kinds. Arguably, this is one of the most educational hobbies in technology that there is. And for those who get pretty heavily into it, they usually derive quite a bit of pleasure out of it. Sometimes some frustration. Radio is not easy. The way it's taught in our schools could be definitely improved. The way it's taught in our books could be definitely improved. You really want a man who understands wireless equipment to make sure you hire a ham radio operator who's got 10 years of experience of building antennas, setting up transmitters, and so on. Somebody who's really been there. Let me drop. If we have the time tonight, I'm going to give you guys a puzzle, a standing wave ratio puzzle about a typical antenna system. It all got started because of the letter that I sent to ARRL, to Joel Hallis, the man who runs the Doctor Is In section, W1ZR. I sent him a letter about his very first answer, giving him some additional information. And I made the letter a little bit too long. It got misunderstood. And I got thanked for my letter, but the subject matter didn't really get approached. So I'm going to give you guys that information and ask you what your impression is, if we have some time. A person signs into the TechNet by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just to say you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. We drop. You might like to know that for the last 10 years worth of TechNets, they're all recorded. And you can play them back by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor. www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back the last 10 years worth of TechNets. There's quite a bit of valuable information there for those who are willing to spend the time. There are college professors, particularly in New Jersey, who tell their electrical engineering students, if you want to see what the world of radio is really like, either listen to the TechNet or listen to some of those recordings. Our usual schedule is for the first hour or so, we handle questions in the order in which they're signed in. If John's available, KC2WTB, we might have a mailbag. We also then have Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report. Paul will be giving a space report number 251 tonight. This particular TechNet is TechNet number 1,651. After 34 and a fraction years. Kind of amazing. Okay, at this time you guys are going to give me your call letters and your name, because you do have a question or a comment. T2RIW listening.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, that was a perfect sign-in. Done just right. Who else would like to check in because they've got a question or a comment? Give me a call letters right now. T2RIW. One more call. Anyone to check in with the questions or comments? Give me a call letters right now. K2RIW. Hey Joe, it looks like it's going to be just you and me tonight. And so take your own free time. And how those electrons been treating you over the last week? The B2RYY. The curious RF maven from the South Shore. Keep your eyes on you there, Joe.
Wow, I can't believe you have no other check-ins. That's amazing. No other check-ins out there listening want to check in, right? Go ahead, take your time.
B2J. What's
No questions. Please comment.
I'm just actually curious if you watched that bit about gravity waves.
When you say that bit, was that a recent email that you sent me, Eric?
Yes, sir.
I think I did. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did. And they're pretty interesting. Unusual, by way of the LIGO detecting equipment, for the first time in the last few years, after decades of speculating about it, we now can really measure gravity waves. Give us a few words on your impression of that website, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
That website is an amazing website. It's called the World Science Festival, and they cover many, many different subjects, and they bring in the scientists that actually made the various discoveries, and they let them talk it out. And I thought you would find that particular one pretty interesting, which I assume you did. K2RIWK2J.
Yeah, I'm a little bit forgetful, and so I probably viewed it immediately, but I'm having trouble recalling it right now. I'll have to go back. You sent that email URL to me, was that about 4 or 5 days ago, Eric?
That's correct.
Yeah, this science jazz, I think it's going to catch on. Go ahead, Joe, with your question. W-H-Y-Y-Y, K-2-I-W.
And what with me? You talking to me?
I'm talking to Joe, W-H-Y-Y-Y, who signed in because he does have a question or a comment. You got it, Joe.
I'm turning my radio back so I don't have any feedback coming in on me here. Let's see. Turn that down too. Okay. Very good. Yeah, this question has to do with DTV. I want to learn more about the cutoff date as far as when channels are going to start disappearing and about what frequency I would not be expected to see stuff above a certain frequency. The reason I'm asking this is because I want to consider changing the filter I have on my TV antenna to have a lower cutoff. Because I am I've been looking up the frequency range around 700 megahertz or so, 705, 710, and I'm seeing, I think the uplink for some of the newer PCS stuff has started to become fairly strong. So I'm not sure if that would bother people's TV sets or overload the converters eventually if the stuff gets stronger and stronger. You see more and more of it, but I want to start being prepared when that take place, when that event starts taking place. I think somebody said, Eric said it, at some particular time, a year or two from now, it's going to eventually shut off some channels above a certain channel. They're going to be going away, and I'd like to know more about that, if that's possible. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, everything above channel 31 is about to disappear. And channel 31, if I got it correct, is around
36.
Oh, so therefore, it's probably around a little bit less than 700 megacycles. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
6. Now I don't remember the number. But the guide band is between 6 and 7. Give me a minute. I'll give you the exact numbers if you really want to know.
And channel 36 calculates at 686 to 672. So that's channel 36. That's going to be the highest one. It looks like 672 is the highest frequency that Joe has to pass. Let's see if Eric can confirm that.
Channel 36 is 602 to 608, I believe, on what my chart says. 608 to 6. Was it 614 or something like that? It's blank on channel 37. So 602 to 608, I think it's channel 36.
You're right. I forgot to subtract the 14. The way I calculated it is I know that channel 14 used to be 470. So therefore, however many channels you were above 14, multiply by 6, add 470 to it. And you're right, 602 to 608 is channel 36.
Okay, so another question related to this also, is the new format, when things start eventually going to the new format, is that going to resemble the old format and still have a carrier spike at 0.3094 above the bottom end of the band? Would it be able to look for that on the air to use it as a reference for calibration purposes, or is the structure of the new coding going to be different?
I think the structure of the new coding is going to be very different, and that particular pilot signal and that particular frequency might not be there. Let's see what Eric's going to say. KE2EJ, when you can come back. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, the new format looks like what if you put your spectrum analyzer on your cable box. It'll look similar to that. There's no pilot per se. Yeah, it looks like the upper channel is 36, so it don't go higher than that, and I can tell you that many of your stations are moving, and quite a few stations actually sold their frequency, so everything above 36 belongs to the phone companies, or at least the cellular phone companies anyway.
Your very best guess, Eric, as to when this new change will really impact us, when we really start seeing something happening, where we can buy equipment, where channels that we're watching disappear, and where until we have the new format equipment in our house, we won't be able to watch television. When will that process begin? 1, 2, 3 years from now? What's your best guess, Eric? K2RIW in the second.
All right, the changeover dates for moving channels, actually, it's done in groups, and it's done by what's called DMA, or the actual number of viewers in a particular area. It's the demographics of television, actually. And I think we're number two, so at the beginning of 2019, everything changes. In New York, and there's some places where it's earlier, and there's some other places where it's later.
So, I think you said the beginning of 2019, or sometime early in 2019. That implies we've got 2 years to get ready for it. My guess is at this time, some of the actual formatting, some of the protocol, is still in a period of flux. In other words, the experts saying how this is going to be done. All the T's are not crossed and the I's are not dotted yet. So 2 years ahead of time, we can't buy any equipment yet. What's your best guess as to when I can start buying equipment? And the equipment that I buy, will it be reverse compatible? I'm almost sure the answer will be yes. So the new television set that I buy a year and a half from now will cover both formats. Is that true, Eric? Good guess. K2EJ, K2RIW.
In reality, it'll cover three formats. The first format is analog. You notice all TV sets will do analog. The second format will be ATSC1, which you're currently receiving, and the new format will be ATSC3. It looks like you'll begin to see receivers probably in the fall. That'll do ATSC3. They're just tidying up a few little things in terms of its data capabilities, and actually I can pull up where they are. Give me a minute for that, and then I'll tell you exactly what the story is. But at this stage of the game, there is no rules that say you have to go off with ATSC1. So we're going to have a landscape which is going to have Actually, I think the low power analogs don't have to go away if they still exist, because a lot of places the frequencies were sold. I think they have to make their change to digital in 2020, I believe it is. Could be wrong about that, but somewhere in that neighborhood. But anyway, there's actually still analog out there, just not in our area.
Will there be channels that are using ATSC number one now, and in the process of changing over to ATSC 3, that for a period of time they'll be transmitting both formats on two separate frequencies, but they'll both be branded as the current channel number, like channel 21 might be transmitting on both the old frequency and the new frequency with both formats simultaneously, or a station's very unlikely to do that because they don't want to pay twice the electric bill. Over here, KQRIW.
KQRIW, K2EJ. Well, there's limited resources in terms of channels, especially when you come into an area like New York or Los Angeles and Washington. The reality is that you're not going to have two transmitters at your facility. You may decide to go ATSC 3 on your channel, and through a channel sharing agreement, which many of the stations who have sold their frequencies will be doing, you'll be doing channel sharing with ATSC 1, probably at a somewhat ridiculously reduced bit rate, while you have your ATSC 3 as your main output. It's really up to the station management as to how they choose to do this. KQRIW-K2J.
Because all the current channels are going to be packed in below 36, my guess is the dash numbers are going to increase. I mean, some of the channels now, we have dash 1, dash 2. I'm guessing there's going to be dash 3, 4, 5, and 6.
No reason for that.
No reason for that? In other words, you're saying even though everybody's squeezed together, there'll be roughly the same number of dash numbers? Over to you, Eric.
No, you seem to forget that the major channel number, when you tune like 4-1, you're actually receiving channel 28. So, the PSIP's allowed you to do your branding however you choose. I mean, we're going to be on 32, but when your dial is up, you'll see 21-1, dash 2, and dash 3 like you do now. For a station that's going to do ATSC 3, the channel scheming will be the same, even though they're completely different in terms of the format of how they occur. You know, the receivers themselves will still have the same tuner, will still have the same basic conversion from tuner to IMQ, and it will have three different chips, one which actually does analog. And by the way, the analog is done in the digital mode. It's not done in the analog in the traditional sense, whereas that you can DSP out the analog signal through your TV set, and there'll be another VLSI that does ATSC 1 and another VLSI that does ATSC 3. So, that's kind of how it's going to play. As far as the branding of the difference between ATSC 1 and 3, it doesn't have to be different. It could be the same channel numbers, except that, you know, 21-1 on an ATSC 3 might be a 4K image instead of a 2K image. So, KQRIW, K2AJ.
When the broadcasters do switch over to ATS 3, make a guess, Eric, in the beginning, and maybe a year or two later, what percentage of them do you think will be transmitting 4K? The new sets we're going to buy, I think most of them are going to have 4K capability. So over-the-air broadcast, or cable, whichever, what percentage of them will be 4K? Eric, ODU, K2RIW.
No, you may not be aware, but Sinclair, which is a large media company, is in the process, if it gets passed by the FCC and a few others, will own all the Tribune TV stations. Tribune being the ones that you know is WPIX, which is Channel 11 in New York. If you're a cable subscriber, you may be getting WGN out of Chicago. Anyway, Sinclair owns a lot of TV stations, there's 200 or something of them. And they, in the beginning, when we went to ATSC 1, they were totally against doing ATSC and they were more into doing COFDM. Anyway, Sinclair stations have now tested several ATSC transmissions, and I think there's one going on now and somewhere in Ohio, and another one on the West Coast. But anyway, Sinclair being who they are, they'll probably be the first one to make the transition really quick. Maybe because they like doing that kind of stuff. They also have an extreme bent in terms of where their politics are, even though they claim they don't. But they're going to be even further right of Fox News in terms of their local news productions. But that's a whole other story. As far as the big four, you know, NBC, CBS, ABC, you may see ABC doing a little faster than a few other people, but that's yet to be found. K2RIW, K2J.
So Sinclair is becoming quite a conglomerate. Owns what I call Channel 11, WPIX. Which I think also calls itself CW. What does that CW stand for? I bet it's not continuous wave. Over to you, Eric.
The C is for CBS, the W is for Warner Brothers.
Did they ever announce over the air what the CW stands for?
Yeah, when it was first created, it was, I forget what it was called now, it's been a few years, but it's a joint venture between CBS and Warner Brothers, and they operate as a network, and they produce all their own programming. It's a joint venture. There's a couple others out there like that, but I think there were two more, but they failed. But the CBS Warner production is the one that actually has been doing quite well.
When I visit my major distributor discount stores, even Walmart, what brands are going to first come out with ATSC-free capable TV sets? Will it be the current brands? Who's getting ready right now and tooling up for this and starting to actually build the equipment that will appear in the stores? What's your guess on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
I have a comment on that.
Well, if you go to South Korea, they're at full swing selling ATSC 3 sets in the major manufacturers, Samsung and the LG. But when it actually starts appearing here, it'll probably be them and Vizio and a few others. It's not a huge change for them. If you're already making a 4K set, by the way, some of the 4K sets are actually not 4K. They're up-resing to 2K screens, so you got to watch it because some of them are a little phony in that sense. But the ones that are making genuine 4K displays already have their ATSC 3 receivers being manufactured at this point. So as far as when they get here, there's no point in bringing them here until there's some transmitters out there.
So they already exist in Southeast Asia, and therefore shipping them here, it's going to be a fairly simple process, similar frequencies and so on. Go ahead, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RIW.
He pretty much said what I was going to say, because I looked up on Google on ATSC 3.0, and one of the links said South Korea is already committed to putting up the newer type of code format, so they're probably going to be manufacturing this stuff very shortly, like through, one of the companies called the Lucky Gold LG Electronics, but it probably is. But I do have one final question about this particular subject in closing.
Go ahead, Eric. I mean, Paul. Here we go. Joe.
Since the format seems to be susceptible to a, you know, a rather minimal, I guess you'd call it, signal to interference ratio, and I've done some, you know, home tests to sort of prove that if something comes within 10 dB of that pilot carrier frequency, it seems to whack out the television signal. Now, even if they remove that on the newer format, will the newer format be as susceptible to a signal 10 dB below what's coming in, or will it tend to ignore stuff a little more, have a little more, you know, susceptibility, and not susceptibility, but protection against something like that? Back to you.
I have the impression, Eric, along these lines, that the COFDM technique is reasonably well deployed in Europe, where television transmission is not a point source like we've got here. It's kind of distributed. And so there for co-channel interference and COFDM seem to be somewhat more compatible. I'd like to believe we're going to get that advantage. Right now, if I get co-channel interference and or multipath, our current ATSC 1 is seemingly, to me, very susceptible, unless you've got some very elaborate back-end processing that tries to figure it all out. So will the new ATSC 3 be a little less susceptible, do you believe? KE2EJ, K2IW?
Well, let me tell you now that one of the pluses of ATSC 3.0, is the ability to have multiple transmitters on the same frequency, distributed around, sort of like cell plates. And actually, the experiment that was going on in Oregon and Washington has a chain of four transmitters that are all within range of each other, all transmitting the same stuff synchronously. So, as far as co-channel interference goes, it's, you know, a heck of a lot better. Don't forget, with ATSC 1, you need an SNR of at least, they say 15, but I say 17 dB in order to be able to get a picture that just about locks up. I mean, my transmitter puts out 36, an EVM of say, 0.7, 0.8%. And then the receiver, its ability to recover that, the signal can degrade to about 17 dB of signal noise, and you still get a picture, but that's where your clip is going to start happening. So, with the form of ATSC3, which is the form of COFDM, they say you'll be able to lock up at something like 12 dB signal noise. But then again, with the ATSC3, we're talking about AM transmission, and with ATSC1, it's actually amplitude modulated, and with ATSC3, it's, let's just call it vector modulated. You know, it's angular modulation completely, as opposed to ATSC1. So there are quite a few advantages. It is less susceptible to multipath, but...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, we only lost the last 20 seconds. When you talked about 0.8%, I'm assuming you're speaking about energy, power, not voltage. And that calculates to a signal-to-noise ratio of around 21 dB. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay, EVM stands for vector modulation. And signal noise is an extrapolated number that comes from that. And if you want to get into that and make the translation, we're talking a whole bunch of math here. When we think of signal noise, you think of it in the traditional way. But when we talk about this digital stuff, we have to think in the traditional way. Plus, error recovery at the same time. So, you know, we've got two different factors, which is making our number, which is not completely in the analog sense of what you think of signal noise is, but yeah, it is. Plus.
Getting back to your previous subject, where I think you said an experiment in the Washington, D.C. area has four transmitters that are all within range of each...
No, West Coast, Washington. No, Seattle, Portland, that neighborhood.
Okay, so four stations in Washington State area synchronously transmitting signals. However, if I'm close to one of those stations and far from the others, I'm getting some number of nanoseconds or microseconds of time delay difference. So even though the material is synchronous, I'm getting them at different times. And it's saying that the converter figures it all out. However, if I'm getting co-channel interference because of a band opening, like we had late last night, all kinds of signals are coming in from very long distances, and therefore a lot of channels are disappearing, like Joe said and Mike said. If there is different material of a similar signal-to-noise ratio and COFDM, ATSC3, what does that new demodulated signal do? Does it hop back and forth between the two channels? I mean, in the analog days, you would see both signals, one is a ghost of the other.
And you would find that they use a 25 kilohertz or 50 kilohertz offset, and you could measure the beat and tell where the station was coming from.
That's the old analog days. We're not going to be able to do that now. So if I'm getting co-channel interference, and because the band is opening so good that the signal coming from a long distance away is almost identical in signal strength to my local signal, two different program materials, what's your guess as to what my new ATSC3 is going to do in that situation, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, number one, it will have a greater ability than ATSC1 in terms of staying put on the station that you tune to. Don't forget, we're talking about, 1,000 Ks in terms of the signal being generated. Also, let's say you've established lock on that particular one, ultimately the decoded clock which comes out that you're going to get from the INQ is going to be clocking at a particular time at a particular rate. And the phase lock loop in the, actually it's a mathematical phase lock loop, will try and stay with that. I mean, one signal becomes so much more stronger than the other, it's going to blank out and you might possibly walk up to the other one. Although, your tour is going to be staying out on my piece of table. I'm using the Hex 60 for this video. And your opposing station may say, well, we're using Hex 42 for our video signal. So essentially, your receiver is just going to go black. It's not like the analog world where you'd see one picture blend into the other. Even if it wasn't running precisely at the same rate, you might see it, creeping up line by line, because it was running at a slightly different speed. You're not going to have those kinds of effects. What will probably happen is it will just blank out on you. Co-channel, especially now that a lot of stations are moving to high and low VHF, you're going to see more of that than you see in the UHF land. But the distances between stations are reasonably far, but, when the atmosphere does its thing, it can really fool you.
Dick?
Yeah, he just said a mouthful there. High and low VHF. Are you saying to Eric, we're going to fill up channels 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 with the new system? And my next question is going to be, if that co-channel interference is 10 dB weaker, will I still see my local channel? Roughly how many decibels of difference in amplitude on co-channel do you believe the new ATSC3 will tolerate? Over to you, Eric.
Now, a few weeks back, I did send you an email with an article about signal noise, saturation of TV stations one next to each other, and the possible differences between ATSC1 and ATSC3. I don't know what the number is. I can look it up. But it's...
it's reasonably small. I mean, you know, it may be, you know, 10 dB difference is where you start getting into trouble. Or maybe a 5 dB difference before you start getting into trouble. But it's just, it's somewhat better than what we currently have with ATSC-1. It's not, you know, it's not the best thing since sliced bread, but it's a lot better than what we currently deal with. But to a degree, I mean, you know, if I'm going to wipe out your front end of my receiver with this co-channel station that's bigger, it's just going to want to hear that rather than the other. It may get confused because there's, you know, all these different carriers may not exactly line up with each other. Yes, the practical part of it we're just learning about now, especially from what's coming out of Korea. But overall, it looks a lot better than what we currently do.
Go ahead, Joe. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, this is along the same discussion here, but the other morning, the band opened up to the southwest. I was getting stuff from Philadelphia. I was also getting WACP. Well, at least I'm getting a signal indication from WACP in Atlantic City, which normally I can tell it's there, but I never lock up on it until it's extremely strong. This time, what happened was I looked at the signal level with my spectrum analyzer, which is gives me a feed off the back of the converter to tell me what level the converter is seeing. On that pilot carrier, on their channel, the level was about minus 56 dBm. And I could not lock up on the picture. It would, the converter simply would not lock up. And usually something that strong, even on VHF or UHF, will make the converter lock up. But in this case, being that's on low band, it wouldn't lock up. In the past, I have seen it lock up. I've gotten a picture from them. And I could not find any other interference on an ether alongside it that was affecting it. So this is kind of like a strange one. But, you know, I guess that's how low band stuff behaves sometimes.
No, it's something to leave an added at.
Like what?
You're looking at it purely from an RF perspective, from a signal level perspective. Okay, beyond, when you're doing DX in sideband or something like that, you know that the polarization shift changes because of the atmosphere. Well, when we're talking about digital stuff, we have this issue called jitter. And the atmosphere can do certain things that will actually create a jitter. And the amount of jitter that it will take before the receiver doesn't know even how to lock up is not that great. So I have to keep my signals that I transmit within, say, plus or minus 100 nanoseconds. That's actually plus or minus 50 nanoseconds. In reality, what we transmit has a jitter of maybe 36 nanoseconds in that neighborhood. So there are other elements involved, especially on low band, because when you have any kind of impulse noise, it appears as jitter to the data separator. So, and that jitter gets carried down the line as it gets processed and turned back into a picture, because don't forget, the picture that you're seeing is really packets, just like coming out of your Ethernet cable. So, and if you work with DMR, you'll notice that if you've seen DMR in the control panel, they give you a signal strength and a error rate. Let me let it drop. In digital television, we have something similar to that. Actually, in ATSC-1, your receiver will actually show you, when you look at the signal level meter, it'll show you AGC action before it shows you ETMO numbers or error numbers, or error bitrate numbers. You'll find that in distance, jitter is more of a factor when you're on low band VHF, a little bit less of a factor on high band VHF, and even less of a factor on UHF. So, get your IWK2J.
On those long range channels that Eric was hearing, that Joe was seeing on his spectrum analyzer, that were getting quite strong, because of the range, I think there's an extremely high probability that a significant amount of multipath was taking place, some direct signals and some indirect signals are always existing when you've got a long range terrestrial signal. And so it's not in lockup. You think it was jitter. I think it was multipath because I know in my particular case, I can be watching a channel that comes from Long Island, a very small number of miles away, and depending on how my antenna is aimed, and I'm getting an echo off of the water tower that's a fraction of a mile from me, I don't get lockup. So multipath of the current system is one of its vulnerabilities as I see it.
Well, multipath really turns out to be jitter.
I'm going to accept that. What, in your opinion, Eric, was the major driving force that made the United States, who had put a lot of research into ATS-C1, to begin to abandon it? What was the major motivation that kicked us over the threshold to say, let's try something else? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
No, if you want some insight into that, I think to RWK Tuesday. You got to go back to 1996 or 95 when the Advanced Television System Committee got together and decided to create a methodology of the next generation of television. And for a number of years, there was quite a big argument between doing ABS-B and the COFDM. Don't forget, the National Television System Committee came up with their method of never twice the same color, and you know, that was ours. It was really a compatible system to the existing black and white system that was being transmitted. And that happened in, what, 1953, 52? RCA got their way instead of CBS and the mechanical color wheel. Although the interesting thing is the mechanical color wheel produced a nice looking picture in those days, anyway. But as far as ATSC goes, you know, it was the Advanced Television Systems Committee, but a lot of folks called it the American Television Systems Committee. So the end result was really politics more than it was technical, but the differences between then and now in terms of how efficient we can transmit. Well, let me hear it drop again. The COFDM system is quite a bit more power hungry than ABS-B to begin with, in terms of what it takes to put that energy out. Although today we don't think of it the same way, because all the transmitters we're manufacturing today have the Doherty amplifiers in them, and we can get into that later, which is way more efficient. And the reason for the we stuck with ABS-B is because of the coverage area for power input, which then when you finally think about the amount of power that you needed at COFDM to cover the same area, then we start getting into, you know, stations banging into each other when the band even opens up just slightly. So there are a lot of reasons. It was somewhat technical, but a lot of politics.
So what I'm sensing from what you just said, Eric, is that we chose ABS-B because it appeared to require less power to get the same range. COFDM looks to me like Europe has done an awful lot of study of what's the best way to transmit over-the-air broadcast television, and they chose COFDM. We thought the ABS-B required less power. However, it is my belief that a significant amount of optimism and mathematical trickery or whatever took place, because when they really deployed it, everybody was promised they would have the same range with digital that they had with analog. Definitely not true. As I see it, the number of people beyond Nassau County that are watching New York City television into Suffolk County, an extremely small percentage of people think they have the ability to watch over-the-air broadcast television with the ABS-B. A significant number of those people in the analog days had it. So I see real decrease in range, and therefore it is my belief, and I
believe in the sociological part out of this argument.
I know you and I are going to disagree on this one, Eric, but I'm convinced that the magic of ABS-B requiring less power to get the same range, I think that was great advertising hyperbole. I don't think it was the reality. Over to you, Eric, on that one. K2RIW.
Central RWK 2J. Well, from a technical perspective, I can tell you this. I've gone to every place where my grade B lines line up, and I can put up an antenna and pick up my stations pretty reasonably. Now, you having your antenna as high as it is, okay, it's a whole other thing going on here. But the reality why you don't see so many antennas is sociological more than it is technical in terms of you want to see CNN, or not necessarily HBO, or you want to see Disney, or you want to see MSNBC or Fox News. The only way you're going to get it is if you plug into a piece of fiber or a piece of cable, because it doesn't exist over here. And when you think about the people who watched out there on the antenna through the snow and the ghost and the ringing when they saw cable, their eyes fell out. So, you know, there's that aspect of things. If cable didn't exist, you would probably see an awful lot of antennas. Now, the one thing about when, and even in the analog days, of what constitutes a grade B area. Let me write it up. Measurements and the actual modeling is done based upon a receiving antenna 20 feet off the ground, including in the analog world. Yes, you could pick up the signal with your rabbit ears in the analog days, and you're 30 miles from the station, and you got a picture. Was it a good picture? It might have been snowy, you might have had a little hiss in the audio, but you got a picture, and people will sit there and watch it. So, that's the difference.
Okay, I've got a further comment on this, but somebody has said he got a question. Who was that? Please give us your call letters and name, sir. K2IW. There's somebody who's got a question. Please wait for the beeps and give us a name and a call letters. K2IW.
K2CJE, Ed.
Okay, Ed, go right ahead with your question.
Those of us that, over the last year or 2 years, that have purchased large flat-screen TVs and are receiving over-the-air TV, how are these sets going to handle the latest digital mode? Over.
You got that one, Eric.
Based upon the people where he's at, sounds like he's somewhere in Suffolk County. Your current TV set, when it tunes to the new standard, isn't going to do a thing. It's not even going to show that there's a channel there. The newer receivers will handle everything, so that's where the difference is. On your older set, they're still not talking about making converter boxes, because it doesn't necessarily make sense. You need a display that will display that high-resolution picture, and there's no point in trying to reduce it, because simultaneously at the same time they'll be transmitting it the old way with the old resolution. So, in the end, depending upon the station owner or the group, whether they choose to continue to transmit for the old TV sets or the older TV sets, that's going to be up to them. It's not mandatory at this point. Back to you, Dick.
I've got an impression from what you just said, Eric, and I'm going to see if I can answer the question another way for Ed. I think you're saying that approximately 2 or 3 years from now, when the United States switches over to the ATSC 3, the new system.
That doesn't mean that people are going to be changing over. They're just changing frequencies 2 or 3 years from now.
Okay. Are you telling me a significant number of channels 3 years from now will still be transmitting ATSC 1? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead. And therefore, Ed can continue to watch those channels?
Absolutely. If they choose in the next 2 or 3 years to put up an ATSC 3 transmitter, they will continue to transmit ATSC 1 piggyback on somebody else's transmitter.
So therefore, it's a little bit difficult to predict for a person who's got a fairly nice, big, expensive 60-inch flat-screen set in his living room right now, and he's not looking forward to spending another great big bundle of money to buy a brand new piece of equipment, how many of the channels that are going to be available 3 or 4 years from now he'll still be able to watch? Right now it's a little bit unknown. There'll be some number of them out there, but some of the particular channels he wants to watch maybe won't be available. Give me some words on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
Well, actually, at this point, for him over the air, there's a number of channels that used to be there that aren't there anymore. And, there's some folks that did the sign-off early. For example, Channel 28, which is NBC, after the transition, Channel 28, which is Channel 4, after the transition, there will be no more Channel 28. Channel 4 will actually be on what you now call 47 as a different set of pieces. So your TV set will actually be tuned to the WNJU station, but the PCIPs will also have the NBC station. Instead of both of them transmitting 1080i, what they'll be doing is they'll be transmitting 720p, and their subs will be running even slower. So, you can pack, there's a couple of stations out there which have like 10 sub-channels, or 12 sub-channels. Some of them are audio, some of them are low-rate video channels, some of them are better. Ion, which has, there's Ion, they have home shopping, they have a few other things. They have their dial really packed. And if you look at their low-end pictures, they look pretty crappy. a slower bit rate, get a nice picture. But let me qualify that. Let me let it drop first. The slower bit rate does not mean lower resolution. It has to do with motion and spatial response. That's where you see the effect. You'll also see in any kind of fast-moving stuff where you might used to see a little teeny bit of blocking or pixelating. Now you'll see a lot of it. The slower you go, the more of that kind of stuff will happen as the spatial motions are moving faster than the refresh rate of what's actually making the picture. So, K2RW, K2J.
So when so many channels are put on the, so many proof,
sorry, I meant temporal, not spatial.
Understand, when so many pieces of material are put on the exact same frequency, and therefore the bit rate for each individual piece of material goes down, you now have more latency, so to speak. You're going to get the same resolution, but the update rate, the update rate is going to be slower. Does that mean that
No, let's qualify that a little bit, because the vertical rate is still going to be the same. It doesn't change.
Okay. Is vertical rate the rate at which my display matrix is read out to the screen? Is that what's going on here? Well, my display matrix is going to be updated more slowly. Therefore, I'm going to see artifacts on fast motion. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Okay, now let's try and put our finger on this a little bit. As far as the display is concerned, the display is reading out of memory. I'd say it's just reading 1920 pixels across the line, and it has 1080 lines. That never changes, okay? What we do at the front end is we actually take those pixels, that information bit by bit, or actually byte by byte, and we serialize it. Then what we do is we break it up into blocks, and then what we do is a discrete cosine transform on them, and we actually, in the end, pull out these coefficients. Are you familiar with, like, FIR filters and IIR filters, or infinite impulse response, or finite impulse response filters? Because if you understand that, then I can actually give you the detail of what's going on.
A long delay line with a whole bunch of taps, and each of the taps have now got coefficients and polarity and magnitude for which I combine the signal. And it's a digital signal I'm talking about. Z transform type things, which is also called, it's got another fancy name. It's what I think you're discussing here, Eric. I'm saying that there is the equivalent of a memory. I call this display matrix, where the updated material is placed, and the rate at which that memory for the picture is updated to the screen, that's your frame rate, which might be 120 frames per second. But the rate at which the material is updated in that memory is what I think we're discussing here. Over to you. Transversal filter. Over to you, Eric. K2LAW.
Okay, you basically hit it on the head in terms of what those filters are. I'm only using that as an example because a DCT is not the same algorithm as you're using for the filter, because when you're making a digital filter, what actually holds the shape or what you use to define the shape of the bandpass, let's say, of the filter, is really what you do is you literally draw the shape of what you want it to be, and from that, through some math, you create a bunch of coefficients, which you use as a multiplicand in the filter. As you delay each tap, you then multiply that by that number, and then you add it. Okay, same sort of principle. So what happens here is that the number of coefficients drop. So the decoder is still filling up that buffer at the same rate, but instead of having it a 8x8 block, we wind up making bigger blocks, so we don't get the change information of this pixel change to this value, the pixel change to that value. And in the process of doing this compression, we try to interpolate between the blocks, and through the math, we actually reconstruct it. So it's kind of like we're still transmitting the same information. The stream rate is slower, but the end result is the same rate what you're feeding the buffer that does the displaying. And in the process of doing that, we decide, oh, this pixel changed shape. We actually do a combination of things. We do something called run length encoding, meaning that if I've got a line, we're looking at a single line.
Repeater, timeout.
If we're looking at a single line, and let's say I've got to put a square on the picture, so that means that the left side of the line is blank, is black, the middle of the line for a certain length is white, and the right side of the line is black. If you do that from up to down on all the lines, you get a bar in the middle. Okay, with run length encoding, we can say, oh, pixels 1 through 512 are black. So what I can do is in 3 bytes, I can say, I've got 50, a value of what the actual value is, which might be, we don't use 0, we'll use a magic number for black, which I think is 27 or 28. And then we've got another byte after that that says, that's the end of that one. Then the next byte that comes along says, I've got 50, and then I've got the value of white, which might be 255. And then we've got another byte that says, I'm done. So far we've got 6 bytes, and now we're going to hit the block on the right side of the line, and we come up with a byte that says, there's 50. Then the value of 25 or 27 or whatever it is, and then an end byte. So for 9 bytes, we can actually describe that single line, all of the pixels that make up that line. That's one method that's embedded into this compression scheme. Now, with ATSC1, we're talking about MPEG-2, which is now quite old, actually. Let me let it drop again. Okay. In the new receivers, that...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Unfortunately, Eric, the machine did not reset properly when it gave its ID last time. We heard 5 seconds of that transmission, and all the rest of it was gone. You might want to try to repeat, maybe in more compact form, your choice. You have to repeat that whole last transmission, I'm sorry to say. Over to you, Eric, KQRIW. Too bad you don't run full duplex.
Okay, no problem.